The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian.com, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. And we still haven't got the latest Smithsonian magazine in yet, so I'm pulling together offline from Smithsonian.com. I think you'll enjoy it. I know some of our listening audience use iPads. You can get the full content of Smithsonian Magazine plus exclusive extras on their iPad edition. And they have a newsletter. Sign up for regular email updates from Smithsonian Magazine, including free newsletters, special offers, and current news updates. Smithsonian.com expands on Smithsonian Magazine's in-depth coverage of history, science, nature, the arts, travel, world culture, and technology. Join us regularly as we take a dynamic and interactive approach to exploring modern and historic perspectives on the arts, sciences, nature, world culture, and travel, including videos, blogs, and a reader forum. Under the heading Smart News, Keeping You Current. In the early days of the 20th century, the students in Bullitt County, Kentucky, were asked to clear a test that many full-fledged adults would likely be hard-pressed to pass today. The Bullitt County Genealogical Society has a copy of this exam and reproduced it, a mix of math and science, reading and writing, and questions on oddly specific factoids preserved in their museum in the county courthouse. But just think for a moment. Did you know where Montenegro was when you were 12? Do you know now? Hint, it's just across the Adriatic Sea from Italy. You know where the Adriatic Sea is, right? Or what about this question, which examiners of Bullitt County deemed necessary knowledge? Through what waters would a vessel pass in going from England through the Suez Canal to Manila? The Bullitt Genealogical Society has an answer sheet if you want to try the test. But really, this question is a doozy. A ship going from England to Manila by way of the Suez Canal would pass through, perhaps, the English Channel, the North Atlantic Ocean, the Bay of Biscay, possibly, Straits of Gibraltar, Mediterranean Sea, Suez Canal, Red Sea, Gulf of Aden, Arabian Sea, Indian Ocean, Gulf of Thailand, may have been called Gulf of Siam at the time, and the South China Sea, where I have gone swimming before when I was in the Air Force stationed in the Philippines. But enough about me. Eighth graders need to know about patent rights, the relative size of the liver, and mountain range geography. They had to be able to put together an argument for studying physiology. Though some of it is useful, much of the test amounts of little more than an assessment of random factoids. So if you're anything like us, no, you're probably much smarter than an 1912 Bullitt County eighth grader. But that's okay. I'm not sure I agree with that. We can look things up so easily now. Tests like this are still done today, of course, often in the form of scientific literacy tests. These tests are meant to give an idea how well people understand the world around them. But in reality, what these tests share in common with the Bullitt County test is that they quiz facts in place of knowledge. Next up, innovations, how human ingenuity is changing the way we live. Science can help us live longer, but how long is too long? Not many people want to live to be 120. That's one of the findings of a Pew Research Center report that came out recently. In fact, almost 70% of those surveyed said an ideal lifespan would be somewhere between 79 and 100 years. Yes, one reason we're wary of that much longevity is the fear of how our bodies and minds would hold up. despite the promise of medical advances that will keep both healthy and much longer. But more than half also think treatments that prolong life for at least 4 more decades could be a bad thing for society. More specifically, 2 out of 3 people agree with the statement that longer life expectancies would strain our natural resources. And while almost 80% of those surveyed said they believe life-extending medicine should be available to anyone who wants it, 2/3 of them thought it would be accessible only to the wealthy. Naturally, this raises some hefty ethical issues, which Pew addresses in an accompanying report. Would so many more healthy old people make it that much harder for young ones to get jobs? Will everyone just assume that they'll have multiple marriages, since one won't have much of a chance of lasting a lifetime? With mortality put off for decades, would people feel less motivated to have children? And the big one, by delaying death so long, would daily life have less meaning? Which brings me to one more question. How realistic is the notion that science can one day make 100 the new 60? For starters, we're not only living longer, life expectancy in the U.S. is now close to 79. That was Innovations. Up next from Smithsonian.com, 5 health benefits of standing desks. Spending more of your day standing could reduce the risk of obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer, by Joseph Stromberg. There was a time when standing desks were a curiosity used by eccentrics like Hemingway, Dickens, and Guericard, but seldom seen inside a regular office setting. That's changed in large part due to research showing that the cumulative impact of sitting all day for years is associated with a range of health problems, from obesity to diabetes to cancer, because the average office worker spends 5 hours and 41 minutes sitting each day at his or her desk. Some describe the problem with a pithy new phrase that's undeniably catchy, if somewhat exaggerated. Sitting is the new smoking. Much of this research has been spurred by James Levine, an endocrinologist at the Mayo Clinic. The way we live now is to sit all day, occasionally punctuated by a walk from the parking lot to the office. He recently said during a phone interview, speaking as he strolled around his living room, "The default has become to sit. We need the default to be standing." All this might sound suspiciously like the latest health fad and nothing more, but a growing body of research conducted both by Levine and other scientists confirms that a sedentary lifestyle appears to be detrimental in the long run. The solution, they say, is to sit for 6 hours at work, then head to the gym afterward, because evidence suggests that the negative effects of extended sitting can't be countered by brief bouts of strenuous exercise. The answer is incorporating standing, pacing, and other forms of activity into your normal day. And standing at your desk for part of it is the easiest way of doing so. Here are some of the other benefits scientists have found so far. Reduced risk obesity. Levine's research began as an investigation into an age-old health question: why some people gain weight and others don't. He and colleagues recruited a group of office workers who engaged in little routine exercise, put them all in an identical diet that contained about 1,000 more calories than they'd been consuming previously, and forbid them from changing their exercise habits. But despite the standardized diet and exercise regimens, some participants gained weight, while others stayed slim. Eventually, using underwear stitched with sensors that measure every subtle movement, The researchers discovered the secret. The participants who weren't gaining weight were up and walking around, on average 2.25 more hours per day, even though all of them worked at sitting desks, and no one was going to the gym. During all of our days, there are opportunities to move around substantially more, Levine says, mentioning things as mundane as walking to a colleague's office rather than emailing them, or taking the stairs instead of the elevator. Failing to take advantage of these constant movement opportunities, it turns out, is closely associated with obesity. And research suggests that our conventional exercise strategy, sitting all day at work, then hitting the gym or going for a run, makes scarcely more sense than the notion that you could counter a pack-a-day smoking habit by jogging, as James Vlachos puts it in the New York Times. The key to reducing the risk of obesity is consistent, moderate levels of movement throughout the day. Scientists are still investigating why this might be the case. The reduced amount of calories burned while sitting, a 2013 study found that standers burn on average 50 calories more per hour, is clearly involved. But there may also be metabolic changes at play, such as the body's cells becoming less responsive to insulin or sedentary muscles releasing lower levels of the enzyme lipoprotein lipase. Of course, all this specifically points to the danger of sitting too much, not exactly the same as the benefit of standing. But Levine believes the two are closely intertwined. Step one is get up. Step two is learn to get up more often. Step three is once you're up, move. I'm seeing a theme here, moving. And what we've discovered is that once you're up, you tend to move. Steps one and two, then, are the most important parts. And a desk that encourages you to stand, at least some of the time, is one of the most convenient means of doing so. Next section, reduced risk of type 2 diabetes and other metabolic problems. The detrimental health impacts of sitting and the benefits of standing appear to go beyond simple obesity. Some of the same studies by Levine and others have found that sitting for extended periods of time is correlated with reduced effectiveness in regulating levels of glucose in the bloodstream, part of a condition known as metabolic syndrome that dramatically increases the chance of type 2 diabetes. A 2008 study, for instance, found that people who sat for longer periods during the day had significantly higher levels of fasting blood glucose, indicating their cells became less responsive to insulin, with the hormone failing to trigger the absorption of glucose from the blood. A 2013 study came to similar findings and arrived at the conclusion that for people already at risk of developing type 2 diabetes, the amount of time sitting could be a more important risk factor than the amount of time vigorously exercising. Reduced risk of cardiovascular disease. Scientific evidence that sitting is bad for the cardiovascular system goes all the way back to the 1950s. When British researchers compared rates of heart disease in London bus drivers who sit and bus conductors who stand, and found that the former group experienced far more heart attacks and other problems than the latter. Since scientists have found that adults who spend 2 more hours per day sitting have a 125% increased risk of health problems related to cardiovascular disease, including chest pains and heart attacks. Other work has found that men who spend more than 5 hours per day sitting outside of work and get limited exercise were at twice the risk of heart failure as those who exercise often and sit fewer than 2 hours daily outside the office. Even when the researchers controlled for the amount of exercise, excessive sitters were still 34% more likely to develop heart failure than those who were standing or moving. A handful of studies have suggested that extended periods of sitting can be linked with a higher risk of many forms of cancer. Breast and colon cancer appear to be most influenced by physical activity, or lack thereof. A 2011 study found that prolonged sitting could be responsible for as much as 49,000 cases of breast cancer and 43,000 cases of colon cancer annually in the U.S. But the same research found that significant amounts of lung cancer, 37,000 cases, prostate cancer, 30,000 cases, endometrial cancer, 12,000 cases, and ovarian cancer, 1,800 cases, could also be related to excessive sitting. The underlying mechanism by which sitting increases cancer risk is still unclear, but scientists have found a number of biomarkers, such as C-reactive protein, that are present in higher levels of people who sit for long periods of time. These may be tied to the development of cancer. Lower long-term mortality risk. Because of the reduced chance of obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer, a number of studies have found strong correlations between the amount of time a person spends sitting and his or her chance of dying within a given period of time. In a 2010 Australian study, for instance, found that for each extra hour participants spent sitting daily, their overall risk of dying during the study period, 7 years, increased by 11%. A 2012 study found that if the average American reduced his or her sitting time to 3 hours per day, life expectancy would climb by 2 years. These projects control for other factors such as diet and exercise, indicating that sitting in isolation can lead to a variety of health problems and increase the overall risk of death, even if you try to get exercise while you're not sitting and eat a healthy diet. And although there are many situations besides the office in which we sit for extended periods, such as while driving and watching TV, for instance, are at the top of the list, spending some of your time at work at a standing desk is one of the most direct solutions. I would say at work or at home. If you're going to start doing so, most experts recommend splitting your time between standing and sitting, because standing all day can lead to back, knee, or foot problems. The easiest ways of accomplishing this are either using a desk that can be raised upward or a tall chair that you can pull up to your desk when you need to sit. It's also important to ease into it, they say, by standing for just a few hours a day at first while your body becomes used to the strain, and move around a bit by shifting your position, pacing, or even dancing while you work. That was by Joseph Stromberg. He's a science reporter for Vox.com. He was previously a digital reporter for Smithsonian. This next article is called In Search of the Great American Beer. Once considered unfit for brewing, wild American hops are making their solo debut on the beer market. Will it change the way we think of American beer? By Natasha Geiling, Smithsonian.com. When Todd Bates moved to a patch of land near Taos, New Mexico in 1991, he had no grand visions of changing the American beer industry. After pursuing a degree in applied math and biology in Ohio, followed by stints as a designer and builder, Bates, then a 28-year-old man, with more background in woodworking than beer brewing, had accepted a job running a quiet guest ranch in the New Mexico wilderness. Tucked in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains and settled by Pueblo people over a millennium ago, Taos is a place of older sensibilities, where Pueblo and Spanish culture mix and endure. So when Bates mentioned to a friend from an old Spanish family that he was suffering from digestive problems, his friend's mother didn't mince words. My friend's mom looked at me and went, "Ah, you people, you move here and you don't know how to take care of yourselves. Our grandparents in Taos would go to the mountains and collect herbs, and we'd never get sick. The only reason you go to a doctor is so they can help you fit in a box." So for the next summer, Bates learned to collect medicinal herbs from the area residents, an array of more than a dozen different herbs used by Native Americans and descendants of Spanish settlers for medicinal purposes. Throughout the summer, one of the crops that kept coming up again and again was something called lupulo, L-U-P-U-L-O, the Spanish word for hop, and an echo of lupulin, the plant's active ingredient. But the hops they were collecting weren't used for brewing beer. But Bates, now 50 years old, with a carefree lilt to his voice, was never fearful of venturing into new territories. He started brewing beer, crudely at first, with the wild hops he was harvesting. He had some previous experience with brewing beer. He'd been known to homebrew a little during high school and college, so he was capable of making a simple, no-frills brew. Even from his bare-bones recipes, Bates discovered that the beer he was brewing with the wild hops ended up being more flavorful and enjoyable than any commercially available beer he could find, and that gave Todd Bates an idea. The common hop, Humulus lupulus, dates back about 6 million years to Mongolia, dispersed by wind and animal carries. Some of those hops migrated to Europe, and about 1.5 million years ago, and 500,000 years later, some migrated to North America. Throughout much of history, hops were split into two categories, Old World hops, those of European heritage, and American hops, known as H. Americanus. In the early 1900s, hops growing in the wild throughout the American Southwest were deemed morphologically distinct enough to merit their own subspecies group, H. lupulus, and I can't even pronounce the next one. Though some argue that American hops can be split into three varieties, those that grow in the Southwest, those that grow in the East, and those that grow throughout the northern Great Plains. The truly important distinction is still between European hops, whose genetic material comes from hops that have been grown and cultivated for centuries in Europe, and American hops, whose genetic material come from hops that grow in the wild throughout the United States. The difference between the American and European varieties is that there are certain compounds in those American varieties, such as geraniol, which gives the American hops a floral quality, often a citrus quality, explains beer writer Stan Hieronymus. The fruity quality in the varieties that people know, gooseberries and melon, are all kinds of citrus, were not always desirable. That's totally new. When it comes to a beer's taste, hops works in two ways. They add bitterness or they add aroma. Some hops, known as purpose hops, do both. The oldest hops, known as noble hops, have been cultivated for centuries in Central Europe and impart a smooth bitterness and spicy or floral aromas. On the opposite end of the spectrum are American hops, which have normally high concentrations of alpha acids. the class of chemical compounds responsible for a hop's bitterness. Noble hops are used primarily in lagers. American hops, on the other hand, are often used in more bitter beers, the American Pale Ale or an IPA. But pure American hops have gained a negative reputation among hop growers and brewers, as Patrick Reeves and Christopher Richards note in their 2011 discussion of wild North American hops. Wild North American hops cannot be directly used in brewing because of undesirable chemical properties that produce excessive bitterness and objectionable aromas. Until Bates introduced his pure American hops to commercial hop growers, any beer brewed with American hops used a hybrid hop, a genetic cross between a European hop and an American hop. But even hybrid hops are a relatively recent addition to the brewing landscape, though hop cultivators in Europe were certainly selecting for certain growing characteristics, taste or hardiness, for example. But there's no evidence of purposeful crossbreeding, especially between European hops and their American cousins. In 1892, an article in the Edinburgh Review made clear how Europeans felt about American hops. American hops may also be dismissed in a few words. Like American grapes, they derive a coarse, rank flavor and smell from the soil in which they grow, which no management, however careful, has hitherto succeeded in neutralizing. There's a little chance in their competing in our market with European growth, except in season of scarcity and unusually high prices. Then, in 1904, E.S. Salmon, a professor at Y College in the United Kingdom, did something rather revolutionary. He crossed a wild American hop with varieties of European hops growing in Great Britain. By combining an American hop with a European hop, Salmon discovered that he could coax certain desirable characteristics from the American hop, its bitterness properties, for example, while maintaining the popular aromas of a European hop. His crosses quickly became darlings of the hop world, and would remain the most widely used hop varieties through the 1970s. And that's our cue to wrap it up. It sure went quickly. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen, and we thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.